Michael Pina from The Ringer joins me to talk about what we liked and what we didn't like coming out of the 2024 NBA draft. We break down the trade that sent Mikal Bridges from Brooklyn to Manhattan, as well as a couple of other deals around the league. And then we check in on how those things shifted the NBA free agency landscape. All that and so much more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends, and welcome to a new episode of No Cap Room. My name is Dan Devine, and I'm a senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. I'm talking to you first this week because my partner, Jake Fisher, is taking a well-deserved day off after the two-day circus that was the NBA draft. And that means that I'm the admiral for the MC Armada today, and it also means I need someone else to talk to. So joining me today, friend of the program and a senior staff writer at TheRinger.com, what a great website, Michael Pina. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm fantastic, Dan. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing really well. I mean, we just got huge breaking news right before we got on the air. It's, you know, it's Quentin Grimes Day here in Brooklyn and here and all across this fine land of ours, in Dallas especially. We're going to get to that. We'll talk about all things trades and off-season and et cetera. But we just got through the NBA draft, as we mentioned, 2 days, definitely necessary. Super important to split that up into 2 days and moving into a Thursday afternoon. It's wrapped up and we've got a lot to talk about, so I want to get right into it. If anyone's looking for like a full round one breakdown, our friend Kristen Peek, who's working overtime this week, had that on her show On the Clock with Tom Haberstroh and Lamar Hurd the other day. So go back in the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed, check that out. But we can move forward here. I'm just wondering, one thing that you liked from the 2024 NBA draft, Mike, anywhere you want to go?
I loved how deliberate Minnesota was trading into the lottery as a Western Conference finalist, getting Rob Dillingham, making him your point guard of the future, giving Anthony Edwards this young potential co-star, like an electric ball handler, co-star ball, someone who can create off the bounce, who can hit threes in the backcourt. And so that was really interesting to me just because, you know, I think people, me included, assume that Minnesota was completely out of flexibility after the Rudy Gobert trade still. And for them to swing this, Tim Connelly, truly a magnificent move by him. And if Rob Dillingham is awesome or even just like pretty good 3 years from now when Ann is 25 and presumably a top five player, that's just like terrific foresight to replace Mike Conley as the starting point guard. So that was just a standout move for me by the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right to sort of bucket it in that like bold venture to say, we're going to give up, it's a 2030, I think it was 2030 pick swap and 2031 unprotected, right? And the pick swap's only top one protected.
Right.
So like, it's far out, it's a handful of years in the future, and unprotected and top one protected, there's a reason teams ask for that stuff because, you know, if things go south for you, that's really valuable. But to say this is our opportunity, we don't think we were a flash in the pan team where like everything broke right for us 1 year. We think this is something to seize, a moment to really go after. And where were we coming up short? You know, that season, like I mentioned this in the winners and losers of the draft thing that I wrote. They were a team that was carried by its defense and by Anthony Edwards' shot creation. They needed somebody else, as you mentioned, who could get their own. And the rate at which they scored against Dallas, like Dallas was just able to choke off too many points of entry for them and say, like, we're not worried about that guy. We're not worried about that guy. Right. And we're going to throw everything at you. One more guy who can beat his guy one-on-one, get to the rim, you know, or get into the paint and create, like, that's worth its weight in gold when you come to the playoffs. And obviously expecting that from Rob Dillingham right now, expecting somebody who's what, like 160 pounds to, and you know, 19 years old to be able to hold up on the defensive end, whatever, like there's concerns with that. But the big picture idea, especially for a team that was so reliant on Mike Conley too, like where is your table setter coming from? I love that. I think if nothing else, there's a big idea behind it and confidence, like a belief in what you've built. I was listening to, I think it was John Gavoni on Zach Lowe's show saying like, well, Tim Connelly's not going to be the GM here in 6 years anyway. He's going to be in Spain somewhere. It's like, well, that's a weird way to like, you know, appraise this and say like somebody else's problem, but maybe it will be somebody else's problem. Who knows? It's funny though, that you went with Minnesota because I was working the other side of that. I love that the Spurs were patient. I love that the Spurs had that number 8 pick. they dealt it to Minnesota and giving up the rights to Rob Dillingham there and getting that 2030, 2031 draft equity, where that's when Victor Wembanyama is going to be 26, 27 years old, like the fat middle of his prime, like as he's just really like should be perennial MVP candidate. Right. And to say it would be cool to get a shot creator with him right now, like given how bad our offense was for so much of last season, you know, may we never forget the point Sohan experiment. I was all in on it and I was wrong, but I was right. I was right because it was like the vibe of it was cool and it was cool to see something different happen. But the, you know, the numbers say, and the eye test said the offense was god awful. So I get it. I get not going that direction and saying like a small guy who can shoot real well and get downhill and create, like everybody's been connecting dots, like a dotted line saying, well, maybe Darius Garland to San Antonio. It's like, well, yeah, but we can get him at number 8. Instead of that, they say we're going and getting Stephon Castle at number 4 out of UConn, and we're projecting everything else out. So the thing that I love, and there's been so much sort of so much concern raised about the lack of shooting in San Antonio, totally legitimate. They got a 6'6 guard who can defend basically everybody, like 6'6, 210, 6'9 wingspan. And they're going to say, like, we want to be huge. Like, you look at the teams that have been really good, the top defenses in the league the last few years, specifically, you had Minnesota, you had Boston, you had Oklahoma City, you had Orlando, like all playoff teams, multiple teams won a series. Obviously, the Celtics won many series and got a big gold trophy out of it. It's positional size everywhere, right? And so Wembanyama, positional size. I think it's fair to say positional size at center. Sohan, 6'9", 7-foot wingspan, can guard all over the place. Devin Vassell, 6'5", 6'10 wingspan, can guard a little, you know, hasn't been an elite defender, but at least is big for a position. Castle, 6'10", like all of a sudden, you're just all over the place big. And I love the idea of saying, what's the quickest way to get good, or at least get decent in the NBA? It's like, don't give up 130 points a night. And so to me, like they're saying, like, we believe what we've got in the star, and we have this principle that we want to build everything around. This, we're building the culture this way. I think it's a smart way to do it.
I think that's a really good, first of all, I totally agree with you. Like, I liked what Minnesota got out of this trade, but I also like loved the flexibility and the foresight that San Antonio had with, oh, we're just going to continue to add draft picks for when Victor Wembanyama is in his prime. Like, that's genius. And I personally don't get the hand-wringing about the need to win right now. I mean, you have this guy for hopefully, you know, 12, 15 years of him being one of, if not the best players in the NBA. Maximize when he's at his best. That makes the most sense to me. But I also just, I think that's a really good point about right now, it makes sense to prioritize defensive focus. And you have, I voted Victor Wembanyama as the defensive player of the year as a rookie. He's, if not the best, second, third, fourth best defender already in basketball, most intimidating presence inside, outside. He can do basically everything already. Instead of giving him someone who would make his life harder, like Trae Young or Darius Garland, let's just be the best defense that we can possibly be. Like, it's I really like that point that you made. And it's like, when the Bucks won the title, it wasn't like, let's get Giannis a score first point guard who would be a weakness. Let's get him Drew Holiday, actually, like the best perimeter, most versatile defender in the NBA. And then they win the title. So I really like that point by you. I didn't even put two and two together there, but that's really a smart way to look at it.
And I mean, that, like, I think it's worth being aware of the pitfalls of that and saying, like, at some point you can't have like 4 26% 3-point shooters, right? Like, you know, you do need to develop the space. I think the only guy on the Spurs who took more than 100 threes last year and made like 37% of them that's coming back is Vassell. Like, everybody else who took volume was not good at it. And I think Jetty Osman was your leader in the clubhouse there, and he's not on the roster. So, I mean, maybe they bring him back. Who knows? Free agency, you know, the bounties can spring eternal. But I think the idea of, if you're betting on player development, you're betting on skill development, and the idea that we can we can do, I mean, they don't have Chip Englund there anymore, and that's a, you know, that's a, an issue, but like, we can get these guys online with their shots. We can develop what they want. Like Castle was, I think, like a 75 or 76% free throw shooter, but there was some, you know, some belief in his stroke. I think there's an idea that like you can, there's something there to build around. There's something to build toward, and like a little bit of a proof of concept where I know everybody wants to get the star point guard. It makes a ton of sense. They were actually like pretty decent in the minutes that Trey Jones played with Devin Vassell and Victor Wembanyama last year. Now, a lot of that is just you play with Victor Wembanyama, you're going to be better than, you know, when you're not playing with Victor Wembanyama. But it was like plus nine per 100 with those three guys on the court over an 800 minute sample. Like he's, I think he's fine for now. And like also not a punching bag defensively. I think that they're taking their time and saying like, we don't necessarily need to go after the home run swing on the offensive end, because this might actually just sort of work itself out. And we're going to give these guys the runway to develop on their own time, because we think that in a couple of years' time, if all of these guys make the improvements year over year offensively, enough of them learn how to shoot better, enough of them improve, then we have like, I think it's like 11 picks in the next five drafts, like lots and lots of optionality and lots of money to spend too, because you're investing in these cheap young rookie contract guys in a cap environment that's going to keep going up. Like they're going to be fun to watch no matter what, but I think the plan makes sense, even if it's a little bit frustrating to say like, well, we could have had the fireworks factory with Dillingham going there too and throwing lobs and making shots. Like they're just sort of exercising patience in a way that I think makes a lot of sense, especially, and I think it's going to make them an absolute bitch to play against on the defensive end.
Yeah, and there's all, we'll see what happens in free agency. Like you can add 3-point shooting with just signing guys over the next few weeks. You don't need to draft them. There's other ways to add talent and build a roster. But yeah, I just kind of fundamentally am just, I'm all about restraint. And you see kind of the mistakes that, I'm not going to say the Dallas Mavericks necessarily are made mistakes with Luka, but they rush things. They're like, oh, we got to get him a co-star immediately. They trade for Kristaps Porzingis because it didn't work out. Eventually, they obviously just made it to the finals and things seemed to be fine there. But took a lot of steps to get there. Right. Obviously, LeBron James is the other, you know, generational talent that we can talk about. In his first run with the Cavaliers, they made it to the finals, but he leaves after the second contract. So I just think, you know, patience, restraint, these are really good, smart things to embrace when you have a talent like Victor Wembanyama, who, like, I wouldn't shock me if, you know, they sign an okay middling free agent, get a little bit of spacing around him, and you know, Devin Vassell stays healthy. If they make the play-in this year, I'm not going to be stunned. That's how good Victor Wembanyama is. And you don't need to try to go all in, or I know just trading. I know drafting Rob Dillingham isn't going all in or anything
sure,
like that.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, I like the mentality of trying to just get as many assets as you possibly can right now and try to have your cake and eat it too.
From there, we're going to go to a situation where you don't get to have your cake and eat it too. I'm so sorry, Michael, but give me something that you didn't like. Like, for example, not being able to have cake or eat it. What was something that you didn't like from the 2024 NBA draft?
I can go in a couple directions here. Can we talk about the Denver Nuggets right now?
Yes, we can. Absolutely. This was not my choice, but I love this choice because it touches on some things we were going to hit later. So I'll just push it up to now.
All yeah. Right.
What concerns you about how things are going in Denver?
So I don't know the player that they drafted. They clearly liked him. And
Daron Holmes out of Dayton.
Yes, they clearly liked him. Traded up to get him. That's wonderful. I hope he's a productive NBA player for years to come. I think the issue that I have here just it ties into the draft, the move that they made yesterday, which was trading Reggie Jackson and 3 second round picks to Charlotte. For the time being, it puts them under the tax. They have 11 signed players that are going to be over the tax. If they were to bring back KCP, they'd probably be over the second apron. So, you know, whatever. But I just feel like when you look at this roster and you look at this strategy that they have in trying to be a quote unquote dynasty and win 2 of 4 or 3 of 5 with Nikola Jokic as their best player in his prime, I'm getting a little nervous. Just like right now, Zeke Nagy is their fifth highest paid player. You know, they get rid of their backup point guard, Reggie Jackson, who, by the way, in a cost-cutting move, who played 82 games last season and was not bad. And when you have Jamal Murray, who's injury-prone, as your starter, having a reliable veteran presence in that spot is really important. And the standings in the regular season for the Western Conference teams really matter. So he was a good insurance policy. He was a good contributor in that role. And I don't know. I'm just like, I'm thinking back to the playoffs when the Michael Malone decides to play Justin Holiday over Peyton Watson in the rotation. And like the plan to develop these guys just didn't really go as I think Calvin Booth hoped. And so if they lose KCP, which all reports are indicating that they will, it'll be really difficult to bring him back. Is Julian Strother really ready to enter a championship or bust team's rotation? Is Jalen Pickett? Is Deron Holmes the guy that they just drafted? Who are they? Are they going to shift their strategy with trying to get more productive players who are veterans on, at the minimum? And you look at who's available, and it's kind of, you know, it's like the Chris Dunns and the Dennis Smith Juniors and the DeLon Wrights of the world. It's just, I have more faith in Nikola Jokic than honestly, like, I think any basketball player of my lifetime. Sure. And this is not ideal. I'll just like, it's just not ideal.
Yeah. There's the, you know, whatever the meme, like, you know, why do you continue giving me your strongest, your toughest challenges? Cause I'm not actually your strongest soldier. He is a strong soldier, but this is a very tough challenge. Mm-hmm. The thing that it made me think of, especially the Reggie Jackson trade, for I believe the price was, sorry, let me just take, look it up here. 3 second round picks, right?
They packaged 3 second round picks to get off of the money. Yeah.
Yes. So the Hornets are saying, all right, we'll take on the salary, but you know, you got the, you're paying the tax with 3 unprotected second round picks. Hey, the Hornets catching religion in terms of how to maneuver in the world, mm-hmm. like, you know, new regimes, incredible. I think of Moneyball. I think of the movie Moneyball, and I think of Art Howe sitting in his office and saying, well, I'm playing Pena every day. And Billy Beane going to him and saying, if you don't play the team as it's built, it's not going to work. And he's like, well, I got control over the lineup card. And so what does, you know, Brad Pitt do is he trades away Pena and then Jeremy Giambi and everybody else that you could play and says, no, it's got to be Hatterberg at first base. Everyone loves how I recap movies on podcasts. But the argument is, let's take away your opportunity to say Reggie Jackson's going to play 82 games and Justin Holiday is going to be your security blanket as a like overtaxed and underused sixth man or whatever. And we're going to say, yeah, now Zeke Nagy might actually, I mean, if Deron Holmes works out the way they want, it might be like Zeke Nagy's on the way out despite being their fifth highest paid player, because they're like, well, we want to stretch backup big who can like has energy and can block shots. And Zeke Nagy just kind of hasn't been able to do that. Maybe Michael Malone hasn't given him the chance, whatever. But like, it seems like they're recruiting over him a little bit. But yeah, I mean, once you get past the top four guys in KCP, it's all guys they've drafted in the last couple of years. And it's, you know, Christian Brown, Peyton Watson. You mentioned those guys, Hunter Tyson. Like, it's not exactly a end of the rotation that's going to strike fear in the hearts of championship caliber teams. But I think that's the idea. And you're right. You know, you mentioned Calvin Booth, kind of the way that he's looked at this KCP situation, which apparently KCP, like, Bella the ball, maybe the board works out in free agency to where he's somebody who gets like is in line for a very big payday, because a lot of the guys that teams maybe thought would be on the market are not available. But Calvin Booth seems at peace with that. Here's the quote that he gave. I believe it was draft night after the first round. We did talking about the Deron Holmes pick, but also like what's coming down the pike. And he says about KCP, quote, yeah, I think you have to look at everything. And the nature of free agency is that he's unrestricted. So we can try to bring him back. And if he doesn't want to come back or opts to go somewhere else, that's his prerogative. So we'll have to work with that. I think we're prepared to like plug and play, so to speak. You look at some of the other teams that have been good in the past, they had to find a way to replace fourth, fifth starters, six men off the bench and keep rolling. It would be nice if he's back. We'd have a lot of continuity together. But all the stuff I've looked at with lineup stuff and everything, Christian Brown's one of the best net rating guys in the league, as is KCP. So I think if he's to step into the starting lineup, I'd project we'll be okay if KCP doesn't return.
Can I jump in real quick? So I saw this quote and then I looked it up. That's like, I don't know what numbers he's looking at, but KCP has, KCP is, yeah, he's up there, net rating, whatever. No, not the case with Christian Brown. That's not factually correct. So maybe he misspoke, or maybe he's talking about some other metric that we do not have access to. But the basics are not that. So I don't know.
When in doubt, it's proprietary. It's always some proprietary in-house stuff. It's a homebrew, analysis that you just can't access. All of which is to say, there is a way to look at it that is, this is the level of belief that we have in our main core guys, in Nikola Jokic, in Jamal Murray, who, despite the injury concerns, and there are a number of them at this point, reportedly getting a four-year, $209 million extension on his big deal. Mm-hmm. So that'll be, Aaron Gordon, I believe, becomes extension eligible in September, and he's on like a $23 million, just like he's in line for a big jump. Michael Porter Jr., is on his rookie max, and they sure would love to get some more out of him, I would imagine, after he shot like 37% in the playoffs. I think what they're saying is, like, we believe in Jokic and Murray and the core four to that degree so much that everything else we plug in around it will work. I mean, I don't know, dog. Like, that's a lot to ask in this West, but it's also maybe just the financial realities of Denver's not, New York and LA, right? It's not the Clippers and the richest ownership groups in the league. It's not a market that necessarily would always bear out luxury tax concerns over a long period of time. So, like, it's, they're in a very interesting spot. And if somebody does come off the top rope for KCP, it feels like they're ready to let him go. But at a certain point, you got to like be. This is not where rushing into putting the best team around our guy. It's, for a fact, he's a three-time MVP, and it is your sort of duty to put the best team around him that you can. So I don't know. Yeah, I think that's an interesting one to watch for sure.
And ownership had a quote recently that was basically, we built this team under a different CBA, and that was really
ding, ding,
tough.
Ding. Yeah.
Tough to hear. Tough to hear. So KCP is a really important piece. I'm not saying he's irreplaceable, but as someone who, bows at the altar of Jokic, I think that you really do need as many airtight on-ball defenders who are genius navigating screens on or off ball with KCP. I mean, he could have made an all-defensive team last season. He's terrific. Yeah. He is a proven winner in the playoffs, hits big shots. His handoff game with Jokic is terrific. So to lose, if they were to lose KCP, maybe they don't, and then Denver can exhale a little bit. But if they lose KCP a year after they lose Bruce Brown Jr., it's just, that's like a depletion of talent that, like, the margins are really not humongous in the Western Conference. And so that's just really worrisome. And it just speaks to how difficult it is to retain your competitiveness in this new NBA climate. And I don't really know how I feel about that.
it's a great, I mean, we've seen that, it happens to championship teams, right? You mentioning the ownership quote made me think of Mark Cuban after the Mavs 2011 championship being like, so we got to get ahead of this new CBA by moving off of all of our guys. And it's like, yeah, but then you don't get back there, right? Like, you sell off Tyson Chandler, you let Jason Kidd walk, you let Jason Terry walk, and eventually you're just back in the middle. No one, whether that is to come for Denver, I think obviously Jokic is going to have a lot to say about that. But it is a difficult set of circumstances, and it's in a league that is tending toward greater parity. Like, that might be feature rather than bug of the system. Whether that's something that we want to watch year after year is, a different category. For me, I will admit this is not nitty gritty nerdy basketball stuff, but I kind of didn't like that it felt like we split the second round into its own thing just so that everybody could go batshit over Bronny James. Like, that didn't feel super great to me. And I say that not as a means of denigrating Bronny James. Like, setting aside whatever things there are to set aside, it felt like the whole point of doing this and splitting it into another day. Like, have you heard a good argument or a better argument for why it happened?
I think that, you know, some GMs have said it's just the time of their ability to make, you know, negotiations and it's less compressed in terms of making. I think Daryl Morey said, you know, we make $100 million decisions in like 2 minutes and we don't have to do that anymore, which, okay, I guess. I don't know. I'm not a GM.
I can understand that, like, operationally, and maybe there were, I mean, I think almost like every pick in the second round last night was traded. It felt like, so maybe the extra time did afford more opportunity for teams to get in touch and do their arbitrage and whatever. From a like forward facing fan consumption point, it was like, all right, well, now we get to build a day of television and commentary around the 55th pick in the draft.
Did you watch it?
No, but I'm like, I picked up children from camp and was making dinner and stuff for them. So no, I missed that. But from what I was gathering, from what I followed, it seemed like, I mean, listen, I don't know. I haven't watched a whole lot of the guys in the draft. Why am I going to watch the draft show?
Fair. I didn't watch it either.
Exactly. I'll find out about what happened on the second day of the draft when they actually suit up in November. But the resultant loudness around it was, it felt sort of all encompassing in a way that, like, the dominant storylines that come out of it, like allegations of nepotism and the shade thrown at the Lakers over the way that they operate and Rich Paul saber rattling and telling everybody he's going to send Bronny to Australia if they take him, and like the idea of the unseriousness of a basketball decision to take him as opposed to like somebody else at 55, or using a draft pick on a family member as opposed to a veteran minimum contract on a family member. Like, I don't know. Do you find any of that kind of shit compelling?
Compelling? No, not really. I first want to say, I think it's amazing that Bronny James was drafted. I feel just, in terms of someone who had cardiac arrest like a year ago or less than a year ago, and to have that moment with his family and his mom, that's like really beautiful. And I like that a lot. I also think that, you know, I would like to think that the NBA is a meritocracy. And I'm sure extremely naive in thinking that, I guess, or hoping that that is a reality in certain
instances.
That
we wind up getting like the 450 best, like that if you earn your way in that way.
Yeah, I just think like it's a lot of it, and a lot of the reaction too, I just felt was very contrived, where it's like he didn't work out for any other team or one other team, and it was telegraphed he was going to the team that, you know, his dad and his agent are very influential on the front office's decision-making process. And what if the front office was like, actually, there's this really amazing player? I know it's the 55th pick, so it's like, I'm not going to get like upset about it or anything.
Sure.
But it's just, will he play a minute in the NBA? I don't know. And so ultimately, I don't know. It's like, I can't get too invested in it either way, because I kind of feel like he was potentially led astray in all of this. Like, maybe you should have just gone back to school, and maybe that, or transfer to a different school, or right, whatever. But if no NBA team would even think of drafting you if you weren't LeBron's son, then maybe this wasn't the route to take. I don't know. So
yeah, no, I mean, Vinny Goodwill, a colleague, wrote a column after the draft, second round of the draft last night, basically like hint or pointing to that idea. Like, are we even sure this is what is best for Bronny, or that Bronny, what Bronny might have wanted ultimately? And, you know, that'll all come out in the wash, or it won't, or it'll come out in a book in 10 years or whatever. But I do think your point about like the, you know, will he even play a minute in the NBA? It's a little bit, it's worth remembering as we discuss where he was selected. Like, he's going to wind up probably being the most closely watched and scrutinized second round pick ever. Like, obviously, we wind up talking about, like, there's many second round picks that we wind up talking about. Nikola Jokic, we talk about Manu Ginobili and Draymond Green and Jalen Brunson. Like, but those guys weren't, they became scrutinized and watched and discussed because of what they became after the fact. Look, like, Bronny's going to get that kind of microscope or the focus from day one. And it wouldn't necessarily be a surprise if he just didn't play. Like, the Lakers 2022 second round pick, Max Christie, has played less than 1,500 minutes the last 2 years. The two guys they picked last season, Jalen Huchefino, who was a first round pick, and Maxwell Lewis in the second round, played 200 minutes combined last year. You don't expect the 55th pick in the draft to play a role or a big role. And it's like, it's not unheard of for guys who are taken that deep to crack a rotation or to wind up playing a role. Fun fact, I did some looking up, some pre-pro on this. Patty Mills, Etuan Moore, and Aaron Wiggins, all 55th picks. So, like, guys can emerge, but they were not rotation players off the jump, right? Or guys like Paul Reed, Trace Jackson Davis, Tumani Kamar the last couple of years, 50th or later, that wind up in rotations. Like, guys can pop and flash and get into the mix, but, like, we are the level of scrutiny that's going to be on what has generally been, like, a comparatively low likelihood of contribution slot is, I think it's going to wind up driving people even more crazy than they already are, which is maybe just everything drives everyone more crazy than they already were. That's sort of the nature of accelerated modern culture. But, like,
can I just read you the press? Like, press release, like, James 6'2", 210 pounds, averaged 4.8 points, 2.8 rebounds, and 2.1 assists in 25 games, 6 starts in his lone season at the University of Southern California. The 19-year-old scored in double figures in 3 outings, including a season-high 15-point performance on December 30th at Oregon State. Like, it's like, what in what universe does that resume get you drafted in the NBA?
Right. And like, it would be, you know, despite your most optimistic notions about meritocracy, like, in what world would a commensurate resume get you in the door at, like, a big hedge fund, if not for, like, your dad being the top salesman at it or whatever, you know? Like,
no, 100%.
So there are components to this. And, like, I made a joke on Twitter, which is a really bad idea. I made a joke on Twitter yesterday that was, like, about, you know, I'm shocked and appalled at the Lakers. And now, if you'll excuse me, I got to go watch the Knicks.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and, like, which then led to a lot of real, you know, winning responses. But... so the number one thing is never joke on Twitter. But the other thing is, like, there are versions of this, and, like, you know, Woj talked about it on TV, and a lot of people have talked about it. There's versions of family business and country club mentality and nepotism that sort of filter in all over the place. The relevant part for Bronny James, I think, and that's maybe the funniest part of all of it, is, like, there have been, I think Paul George on his podcast was like, yeah, no, I've worked out with them, and, you know, I see, like, Jrue Holiday, I see Derek White, and... that is kind and optimistic, right? But if you're talking about a player type, like, some of the more maybe relevant player types or the more humble player types that have been compared, or it's like Davion Mitchell or D'Anthony Melton, or...
By the way, that's who Bronny compared himself to.
Yeah,
Davion,
right?
Mitchell. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you know, others, you know, sort of draft Knicks that have looked at it and said, I don't know, like, Deuce McBride maybe, or Gary Harris, or Aaron Holiday. Like, if that's who he winds up being, like, that's a totally fine player. Like, that's a completely legitimate NBA player that can last 10 years in the league and make a bunch of money and be a helpful player on, you know, playoff teams and have moments of consequence. If, like, and honestly, that kind of guy would help the Lakers if that is who he develops into and is able to play, like. And so that's, I think, the story moving forward. Obviously, the biggest story is going to be when they check in for the first time together, and is there, you know, they connect on a basket or the alley-oop pass or whatever. And that's all awesome. Like, that's cool as hell. And I think we like stories and storytelling in this world, and I don't think that's a dirty word, and it's all right. That's great. What level of development he's able to achieve and how the Lakers are able to develop him from here on out, that's the part that matters. And I'm rooting for, especially somebody who went through what he went through last year with that cardiac incident and, like, being able to get all the way to actually realizing his dream. I'm rooting for him. I hope that it actually pans out that way. but there's a long way between here and there. And I think that it's going to be, he has an awfully difficult path to walk just by virtue of all of this other stuff surrounding it.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, in a way, feel a little bad for him. I think that this situation is ultimately not in his best interest and will be, as you said, extremely challenging in a lot of ways in terms of the spotlight and the... I don't think anyone's like, oh, he's going to be as good as his dad. Like, that's stupid. But just the situation that he's kind of been thrust into is one of... It just doesn't do him any favors. And I don't think he'll be given the benefit of the doubt by the general public. And that's a shame. And so... Yeah, I root for his happiness. I root for his success. But I just, a part of me, you know, talking about storytelling, like that's, you know, as a journalist who's a little bit cynical about these sort of things, part of me is like, what is the real motivation of coming out and being so committed to, you know, threatening every team that would take him, as if like, a threat needed to be made to any of the other. It's just like, it's so dumb. But, you know, again, like, I hope he's happy. I hope he has success. And I hope he enters an NBA game and plays with his dad. That would be really cool.
All right, we're going to take a quick break to pay some bills. And when we come back, we'll talk about more players who are going to check into NBA games. Probably not to play with their dads, but we'll talk about more of them coming up on No Cap Room. Welcome back to No Cap Room. My guest, Michael Pina of The Ringer. And we move from the draft to some trades, some big trades that have happened over the course of the week, sort of moving into the rest of the offseason. Want to start with the biggest one that happened this week. No, not the Quentin Grimes trade, although I promise we will get back to that. The Nets and the Knicks combine on a big one. Mikal Bridges completing the Villanova Voltron in Madison Square Garden, going from Brooklyn to Manhattan. You've probably heard it already by now, but let's go with it. The Nets wind up with four unprotected first-round picks, 2025, 27, 29, and 31 from the Knicks, plus an unprotected 2028 first-round pick swap, a top four protected 2025 first from the Milwaukee Bucks, a 2025 second-round pick, and Bojan Bogdanović, who gets to go back to Brooklyn. I wonder if he still gets his old locker. The Knicks get Mikal Bridges and a 2026 second rounder. I know you wrote about this at The Ringer. Just your first blush thoughts about that deal when you saw it go down.
I think my first reaction was, oh my God, like five first round picks.
Yeah.
That was by far my snap judgment of it, where it was just like, okay, they can't all be unprotected. Okay, four are unprotected, owned by the Knicks.
Yes, which is, it's all Knicks picks, right?
Which is amazing. And then they get the protected one from the Milwaukee Bucks and a second and a swap, I think. Like, that is, plus Bogdanović. That is, like, such a win for the Brooklyn Nets that it's amazing for them to just have... You know, you have to combine it with what they did with the Houston Rockets, where they get their own picks back in 2025 and 2026, which allows them to control their own destiny, to actually tank and to just kind of shift their whole mentality as an organization from we're going to build up a culture so that we can attract free agents to, you know, I know they're going to have a lot of cap space and cap flexibility going forward, but I truly think that this is a big market team that wants to behave and act like the Oklahoma City Thunder. I kind of get that sense from them, and that's good. It's like deep pocketed, but really shrewd in your decision making and your asset allocation. I think that's great. And to exchange Mikal Bridges, who I think is like awesome. He's an awesome player. He'll never be an all-star and he'll never make an all-NBA team. And that's whatever. That's fine. But to get five firsts for someone who, I mean, last in January, I wrote this column, like the five least improved players of the season. And he was one of them. And a lot of that was like the situation that he was in Brooklyn, which was absolutely terrible. So it's like no fault of his own, but still. So yeah, I just thought that that was like a masterstroke by Sean Marks. And I also want to say, which kind of juts my point a little bit, but like, Sean Marks has hired 4 head coaches. Like, I don't understand why he gets to continue to do all this, but he's doing a really good job. Yeah. Like,
we stand a job security king. You know, there's no there's no way to turn your nose up at how he continues to survive. He's got alligator blood there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there you're absolutely right to note, like, this feels like you touched the free agency stove, the superstar stove, once, realized it was really hot and it burned your hand, and you're like, maybe I don't touch the stove anymore. Like, that's mm-hmm. how I learn. I think that their proof of concept in terms of building a competitive team, they were able to do it that, like, kind of grind it out hard way before without any of their picks. So I think the idea of let's do that again, but this actually, like, we can benefit from being maybe the worst team in the league or one of the worst teams in the league. There's a lot of sense mm-hmm. to that. I think the final tally winds up, because as you mentioned, the Rockets trade, they give the Rockets control over 4 future firsts in exchange for getting their own 2025 and 26 back. So I think it's like 12 first rounders or 13 first rounders over the next 4 or 5 drafts. So like, they've got ammo and they've got their own picks the next couple of years. So that's how you start this process off. And you know, Houston being able to, like, no, we're just going to change our focus and short sell Phoenix now. I think that's really interesting, but I want to move from Brooklyn, because they also re-signed Nick Claxton. 4 years, $100 million deal. I saw some speculation. I think it was one of the guys at Nets Daily. I might be wrong about that, so forgive me, that Brooklyn might look to, like, front load that, pay off the biggest part of it in the first couple of years, so you have more financial flexibility in the back end of it, or it makes it more tradable down the line if you need to move him for, you know, some kind of future deal. But that is $25 million for a pretty good to very good defensive center. Like, that's a going rate kind of thing. That sounds seems fine. But yeah, like, the Nets are, I think they're going to be bad. We'll see them again in a couple of years. The Knicks are, I think, not going to be bad. And so I want to, I mean, you and I know that I am a New York Knicks fan. I grew up a New York Knicks fan. And I also know that you are not interested in that. And so the Bridges trade comes in conjunction with them bringing back OG Anunoby on a monster deal, 5 years, $212.5 million. I think in a vacuum, you look at it and say, OG Anunoby is going to make $42.5 million a year, and your eyes pop out of your skull and then roll down the hall like in a Warner Brothers cartoon or something like that. But it's about $30 million less than the full max he could have gotten. It'll be about like the kind of 25% max in terms of the structure of the salary cap. Cap goes up, share goes down. Not saying it's going to be a deal by the year 3 or 4, but like, that's the idea. It is a deal that is happening in the context of this cap environment. All right, before we get further with that, shout out to Emmanuel Quickly, traded to the Raptors as part of the OG Anunoby deal, who got paid himself today. 5 years, $175 million in restricted free agency to go back to Toronto. Good job for you. Quick skip on that. That's pretty fun. So the Knicks, as it stands, look at their rotation is Jalen Brunson, Dante DiVincenzo, Mikal Bridges, OG Anunoby, Julius Randle, still there is a very interesting piece, Mitchell Robinson, Josh Hart, and Deuce McBride off the bench. How do you assess where they are right now and, you know, what they come out of this series of transactions with?
Yeah, they're an awesome basketball team. I wrote a column about, I mean, I said that my snap reaction to the deal was the picks, but the story is the Knicks, because they're the good team that is trying to win. And Bridges is a seamless fit basically anywhere he goes, but particularly on this roster with 3 teammates who he won a national championship. Well, he won 2 national championships with 2 of them, and then 1 with Josh Hart. That's like, it's amazing. Like, that's obviously unprecedented, and their chemistry should be, you know, hit the ground running. I think they'll be really good. I think there's, I'm a little less willing to just slot them in as the second best team in this Eastern Conference. I would like to see this offseason play out before I do that. There's a lot of questions in the East with the other pretty good teams. And I'm really curious to see what happens with Isaiah Hartenstein, who was one of their best players in the playoffs last year, one of the best defensive centers in the entire NBA last year. So if they lose him, I want to see their front court depth, because their identity, in a sense, it will kind of not dramatically shift, but maybe dramatically shift. You know what? Like the offensive rebounding, you know, pound the glass, very physical. Like, I think it'll be a little, like, it'll be hard to do that, obviously, if you have Mitchell Robinson as your lone big and he gets hurt every year, and, you know, who's going to be his backup? But then it's just a more, like, I don't know if Sunui is the right word, just like a let's just say, like, they're more versatile, and they have, you'll see OG Anunoby probably play the five a little bit more. You'll see, you know, Josh
like
Hart.
I feel like Tibbs, like, getting, like, angry at the idea.
Yeah, but, like, you'll see him play at the five in certain matchups and certain stints. You'll see Josh Hart at the four, was 6'4" guy playing power forward. I think that they just have this really interesting rotation as currently constructed. And at the end of the day, something that's overlooked also, well, first of all, I should say, when I started writing my column, I was like 150 words in and before I remembered that Julius Randle is on the team. Like, I don't know how many.
Yeah. There's a reason Julius has been doing a lot more TV and podcast and appearances and stuff, I think. I think he wants to make sure people remember that he's out there.
Yeah, and he's extension eligible right now, and he's a two-time All-NBA player in a Knicks jersey. Like, it's kind of, like, I want to see how that fits. I talk about, like, the great chemistry with Mikal Bridges sliding in, and I just think of it as, like, a four-man team, but, like, yeah. There's other pieces here, and I wonder, I know they like Julius Randle. I've never been a huge Julius Randle person, and so I wonder, do you, like, is he on the team in April? Is, like, a really, I think that's, like, a legitimate question here. And I think that that'll be dictated in a large part by what they do with their front court and how they, if they have to replace Isaiah Hartenstein, what they do, because they need some size, and Randle is a pretty good rebounder for his size. So, yeah, I just think, like, there's some questions as there are with every team.
Sure.
But they're really good. I stop short personally of being like I don't know. Like, I shouldn't say I stop short. I think that they are a contender. And I think that Brunson, if Brunson is Brunson, which there's no reason why anyone should say that he's not, what last year was, there's no reason why he can't sustain that if he continues on that track and even improves a little bit. This is a top, like, easily a top 10 player. You know what I mean? Like, he's a superstar.
Yeah.
So,
I think fifth in MVP voting in All-NBA second team this year. Like, yeah, that's the math. That's the category.
Yeah. So when you have one of those guys, and you have really, like, you've built around them in ways that accentuate strengths, cover up shortcomings, you are a contender. Like, it's really hard not to be. And I think that they've done that in a lot of ways. So it's kind of a brilliant run by this front office, honestly. You can't really take anything away from them. And I'm in, like, wait and see mode to see how the Philadelphia 76ers build their roster. The Milwaukee Bucks are kind of whatever, but I want to see them play basketball.
Sure.
And they have a lot to prove and a lot of pride and essentially a new head coach in a lot of ways. But, like, yeah, I'll put the Knicks ahead of the Pacers. You know what I mean? Like, they're a really good team.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't shock me if they made the conference finals.
Yeah. So they're in that conversation. It's a question of, you know, sort of how seriously. But let's move to two teams that are pretty seriously not in that conversation. The Washington Wizards trade forward Denny Avdia to the Portland Trailblazers for Malcolm Brogdon, the 14th pick in the 2024 NBA draft, used on Pitt's Bub Carrington, which is one of the coolest names in the draft, and also a 2029 first-round pick and future second-round pick. So there's, like, four draft assets all told, and Malcolm Brogdon is the freight for Denny Avdia. Talk to me about the Wizards side of this. You know, obviously there's an asset component to this, but how do you like what they did here in terms of moving off of Avdia?
I don't know, because I liked Denny Avdia. I think he's a success story in terms of, you know, this team has drafted really poorly, this organization, over the years. There's a lot of misses. And I think that he was developing into a clear win with the slot that he was selected at. And he has a lot of value. He's on a, you know, arguably the best contract in the entire NBA. If I were to list the best best value contracts, his would be on it. It declines.
Like four years, 55 declining, right? Something like that.
It's amazing. He's 23. I really wanted to vote, like put him in my finalist most improved player ballot. He's got size. He's shooting threes. He can create a little bit. He's like, I don't know if he's an underrated defender, but he's like a good defender, versatile defender.
Yeah.
Versatile offensive player as well. And positionally makes a lot of sense in Portland around the players that they have as they grow. Hopefully they do grow and kind of embrace a youth movement. For Washington, yeah, it's like I get, you know, trying to get picks. One of the picks was like a mid-lottery pick in this draft that everyone says sucks. And is that player ever going to be Denny Avdia? You know, like, so if you're rebuilding and you get rid of a 23-year-old who is homegrown, who, again, is getting better and better, and we don't know how good he'll ultimately be, I don't really understand that one, to be honest. Probably would not have made this trade if I was the Washington Wizards. And I think it's a pretty big win for the Trailblazers, who also, it should be mentioned, duck under the tax by making it. So that's smart. Just smart business. Get the best player in the trade. And I guess they can flip. The Wizards can flip Brogdon. We'll see. I would assume they will. See if they can get more draft allocation there. But yeah, I like Denny Avdia. So I'm going to say that the team that got him won the deal.
Yeah, I like that. I think you're right. I think the way station component for Brogdon is, they've got Jordan Poole there. You've got Tyus Jones there. Like, it makes a lot of sense to try to find a sort of to reroute him somewhere else. I won't go too big on the Blazers, because my note here was just like, am I nuts for liking the way this all shook out for them despite the draft assets going out? And I wrote about this in the winners and losers column I did. Like, you bring in Donovan Klingon at number 7, who's like 7'2" shot blocker, a guy who locks down the paint and erases shots at the rim. And you bring in a big wing who can defend multiple positions on the perimeter. Like, again, going back to that idea, the shortest path between bad and respectable is like stop giving up 130 points. And when you're playing Scoot Henderson and Shaedon Sharpe and Anfernee Simons, and like you don't have point of attack defenders, more guys who can stop, and then someone who can erase those mistakes at the basket, I think makes a ton of sense in terms of like, we have not known who the Blazers really want to be after Damian Lillard. And if the idea is we're going to start here, I think that makes a ton of sense. And it's going to mean, that does not mean that they are like particularly close to anything, but I think as a starting point, and then, you know, like if, as you mentioned, Denny Avdia is super valuable contract, like if the Blazers decide they want to figure something else out there, like I guarantee you there'll be more suitors for him down the line too. So you preserve some optionality. You maybe get to recoup some of those picks if you want. And in the meantime, you start building something sustainable, like an actual spine on the defensive end. I think that's there's a place to start there. Guys, we've been teasing it. We've been talking about it. Dallas Mavericks trade Tim Hardaway Jr. and 3 second round picks. Looks like a 2025 second via the Toronto Raptors and 2 2028 second rounders to the Detroit Pistons, and they get back Quentin Grimes. I know you like sat with Quentin, right? Like in the run up to the draft, you wrote on him, didn't you?
Yeah, we did a Zoom interview. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So your first blush reaction to hearing Quentin Grimes to Dallas, Tim Hardaway Jr. to Detroit?
I like Quentin Grimes a lot. I think about the steal he had 2 playoffs ago against Jimmy Butler in crunch time when it's like he was on one leg. I think about that play a lot. It was awesome. I totally understand what Detroit is doing, though, trying to get as many picks as possible. And I would assume that, you know, they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. apologies for using that expression like seven times on this pod, but
don't apologize for making me one cake, my friend. I'm probably gonna go out as soon as we get done with this. I think I got some carrot cake in the fridge. I might go scoop that up.
You know, they're trying to get assets, but also get players who are not terrible, who will complement.
Put that on the banner. The Detroit Pistons, players who are not terrible from now on.
And, you know, Tim Hardaway, he's a streaky 3-point shooter, but it's someone who you're not going to entirely leave alone. And so for a team that really hasn't had any good 3-point shooting around Cade Cunningham his entire career and just drafted someone who shot like 27% with the G League Ignite last year, Ron Holland, you know, I think that that's cool. That's makes sense. It's a sensible move. So I get it. He's not really on their timeline, of course. And maybe they'll flip him. I don't know. Maybe there's like more demand for Tim Hardaway's expiring contract, but I get it. I get it for both sides, really.
Super producer John Gennaro, noted Mavericks fan. I am yelling out your name. Do you want to come in and talk to me about why this makes sense for Dallas?
I will keep it very, very short because we're running a little bit behind. But I will just say that Tim Hardaway Jr. did not have a place on this Mavericks team anymore. And Quentin Grimes is an actual good basketball player coming off the bench. So very helpful for the Dallas Mavericks.
Actual good basketball players. Put that on the banner also. I think that's all in terms of the trades to get into. Although I have to imagine that at some point soon, there are going to be a lot more Nets trades, like Dorian Finney-Smith going somewhere, Cameron Johnson going somewhere. Mm-hmm. Maybe Bojan Bogdanovic goes somewhere else and we have more to talk about with him. But for now, we move from the trade market to the free agency market. Free agency gets going this weekend. The unrestricted market, I mean, it's kind of already going. Like, we've had a number of based on the rules changes this year where teams can negotiate with their own free agents. We've seen a number of deals agreed to. We just talked about Nick Claxton. We talked about Bridges. We talked about OG, you know, all these sorts of things. But as we head into the start of free agency this weekend, I know you wrote a sort of big, you know, big questions about free agency primer for the Ringer. People go check that out. What's the first thing that you're sort of the main focus that you think biggest question as you head into free agency?
I mean, besides where Tobias Harris will end up,
it's on everybody's lips. I mean, I think you can't open your inbox without getting an email from a publicist suggesting that Tobias Harris might be the belle of the ball.
Goes without saying. I think that Paul George is obviously the,
him.
Yeah, that guy. I think he's the obvious headline here. And there's a lot of there's like myriad possibilities. And we don't know right now if he's going to opt in, opt out, stay with the Clippers, get traded to the Warriors or the... or sign with the Sixers, or sign with the Clippers, or there's a mystery team he'll opt in and be traded to. So I think that there's just a lot of mystery and wonder, and I think that also Paul George is a little... Is it fair to say he's kind of like underrated as like a very, very, very good basketball player?
You know what? I had a moment when you paused. I thought you were going to say overrated. And then I remembered that you're the guy that picks the Clippers every year. So I think if he's on one end of the spectrum, and maybe this is, again, just in our, like, you know, NBA sicko, we live in this bubble kind of situation. I almost feel like it's the other way because there's just been so much conversation about how he is like the meta for what a wing player needs to be. In today's NBA, you know, Brandon Miller, there's all the discussion last year of like, he's my GOAT. And then there's sort of a lot of excavation of why. I know our friend Rob Mahoney recently wrote about that for The Ringer. Like, here's why he's the build. Like, if you were starting a 2K play, create a player, it would look like Paul George. So I get it from that perspective. But I also think like there have been relatively few, there have been some significant playoff runs and some major, major moments for Paul George over the course of the last decade or so, but maybe fewer and further between than his all NBA count and all star count and reputation might indicate. So what makes you say that you think it's more on the other side of that, that he's still sort of underrated in terms of what value he might have?
Well, like if we're to add context on the playoff thing, like I thought he totally acquitted himself in 2021 with that run after Kawhi Leonard got hurt.
Absolutely. That was like the redemption narrative for him. Absolutely.
Yeah, I thought he played tremendous. He was everything on that team offensively. He had to do so much. There was so much responsibility. And I thought that he totally acquitted himself. And so this past year was his first time back in the playoffs since then. Like, he hadn't played a game since 2021. And Kawhi Leonard was hurt. And so, like, Paul George is ultimately not supposed to be the guy. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he was up against, like, he wasn't the best player in the series, obviously. And as just, when I say underrated, I mean, like, this is someone who just crossed the 2,000 minute mark for the first time in a Clippers jersey. He was, I think, only four players made more threes, only three players had more steals than him last season. His per game numbers will be a little bit lower than you would like because his role completely shifted with James Harden coming on board. So the assist numbers drop, et cetera. But he was very efficient. And I just think he's like of the stars in the league. He's one of the 5 to 10 most versatile offensively and defensively. And he is just so like, if he were to actually go to, I have a lot of thoughts about this. We could talk about this forever. Like, if he were to go to the Sixers, I just think he's such a perfect co-star.
Like, absolutely.
Just,
yeah.
He checks so many boxes and there's so few weaknesses. And I think that that is really, really, really important. And he's been, through no fault of his own, because of Kawhi Leonard's knee, miscast over the past couple of years, or past few playoff appearances. And so, you know, the bubble was the bubble. It's like a million years ago. And sure. It's like kind of irrelevant to me. But I think I see more about like his age and the contract and stuff. And I'm like, yo, this guy is so awesome. He's like an awesome player. It's not saying I would give him a 4-year max if I was the general manager, but just as a player for next season, I think he can still swing a championship race. I think he's still that good.
The fact that, I mean, we've talked about this a number of times, Jake and I, and on other shows, like, you have to assume at this point, the fact that he is not re-signed with the Clippers indicates that the Clippers have yet to be comfortable enough going to the fourth year, right? Like, the idea being, we gave Kawhi 3 and 150, that's where we want to keep you as well. And him being like, I'm not comfortable in that neighborhood. I would not like that. So I firmly believe that the Clippers would, or that the Sixers rather, would go to the fourth year. It just, does he want to go to Philadelphia? I think you're absolutely right to say he fits so perfectly between Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey. If you are Paul George, do you want to sign up for another knee haunting situation?
Fair.
You know, to move across the country to do that? I think that's a big question. But also just worth noting, Lawrence Frank, Clippers personnel chief, says, quote, it is after their they sort of post-draft press conference, easy for me to talk, professional broadcaster, quote, we love Paul. We very much want to retain Paul, but we also very much understand and respect the fact that it's a business. Glad they very much understand that. We hope Paul's decision is to be here. He's been awesome. He's been an all-star, been one of the best two-way players in the league. He's a terrific person. He's got great family. So we hope he's here, but also respect the fact that if he chooses to opt out, that's his choice. He's earned it, and we'll see how things play out. That does not necessarily sound like we are super comfortable going to 4 years in the full boat max. It's, you know, yeah, we want him, but like, maybe we want him at the price we want him at. And so there are roster building components to that. There's the second apron of it all. There's Steve Ballmer, despite not having to look into his couch cushions for $160 million. Like, the idea that you are severely limited in terms of how you can build a roster moving forward, the more you spend into the aprons, there's a lot to consider there. But where he goes, I think you're absolutely right. Where he goes is like, that's the starting point for pretty much everything else. DeMar DeRozan might wind up being connected to that. There's the Chicago situation, which, do you want to take just like 2 minutes and talk about how Chicago is like the most depressing place in the NBA? Because I know that's a hobby horse for you, and there's certainly no reason to not feel that way right now.
Yeah, it's just this like such a stubbornly oblivious organization, and I feel just so bad for their fans. You see Mikal Bridges get, the Nets get 5 firsts for Mikal Bridges, and then the, like, Alex Caruso is not better than Mikal Bridges, but he is better in some ways. And to get, and he's also older, but like to get just Josh Giddey for him, like I, you know, it's just, it's a lot. And I think that this offseason, one of the things I wrote about was the Bulls and how if this is a real pivot to a rebuild and a tank job when there's not a ton of teams tanking, then that's amazing and they should be applauded. And it could go a long way in terms of just setting this organization on the right course finally. And that means letting DeMar walk. Obviously trading Zach LaVine and trying to get something for him. Shopping Nikola Vucevic, you're probably, I don't, you know, that's going to be a tough one. I don't know what the market is there.
You might have to go to Facebook Marketplace or the, like the, you know, go free kind of, you know, like anybody want free to a home if you come pick them up kind of situation.
But just like have your Giddey, Kobe White backcourt. I would bring back Patrick Williams if the price was right. He's a restricted free agent, super young still, and be this fast, up-tempo, fun, absolutely terrible basketball team next season. And I think their first round pick is owned by the Blazers, I believe, but it's top 10 protected. You can't just make the play-in and not get that pick. Like what is going on? This is a perfect year for it. It's a very good draft, supposedly. Everyone says that. Start over. Like it makes no sense. You can't have DeMar and Giddey. Like just what are we doing? So please start over. change your reputation, change how you're perceived around the league. And this is a good opportunity for them to do that. And I hope they do for their fans' sake, because it's been just a long, tough road for these people, these poor people, for years.
I mean, they can always, you know, Bulls fans can decompress and, you know, not stress out by watching the Bear. It'll be less stressful than dealing with the Bulls. We're going to get out of here, but I want to ask, is there one other player or one other team, whatever, one other situation that you are like, that is going to be fascinating? Whether it's like, this is going to shake the title or not, like, I just really want to see what that's going to be like, what they're going to do, where he's going to go. Like one last one that you're like, that's one to really focus on.
I think that Brandon Ingram as a consolation prize for Paul George really fascinates me. He is like 8 years younger. And I talked about like Paul George being underrated and whatever. I think Brandon Ingram is like by far the most underrated player in the NBA. I'm a huge fan. I think that I understand the warts to his game. I think some of it is unfair. And I think that if he were in the right spot and he tapered a little bit of his responsibilities in a way that, you know, he's a little bit more willing to shoot threes, which he can hit. And I don't understand why he wouldn't. It's not out of the question, but I think he's someone who he brings it on defense and has been a part of really good defensive units. And he has one of the most unblockable mid-range jumpers in the league and has never really had an opportunity to showcase it in a playoff setting where it would be really important. But I just think that he can be like Chris Middleton 2.0. Like put him on a team where he's like clearly the second best player, or he's splitting, you know, dueling like a 2A, 2B with someone else. Like put him on the Sacramento Kings. I think that that would be really fascinating. I'm not saying they win the title or anything like that.
Sure.
Slide him into the Sixers. I think, you know, there were on Zach Lowe's pod the other day, he mentioned that there were rumors about Jeremy Grant and Brandon Ingram being players that the Sixers and Daryl Morey are sniffing around about. I think that that's pretty smart. I think that, like, I think he's a star. I really do. And so he's made one all-star team in his career. He's, you know, battled a bunch of injuries, but it just, if you read the tea leaves of what David Griffin's saying, vice president of basketball operations with the Pelicans, it doesn't seem like they are willing to give him the max extension that he's eligible for. And I think that this could be the time for a clean break. And that fascinates me because he's really good. And I would love to see him in a situation where there's like actual spacing and he's not having, there's not such an offensive burden on him with a co-star who's always hurt.
Yeah, and you, you're right. It feels like the circumstances are leading to, like, this is the opportunity for the break. Like, Trey Murphy the third is like pushing into that starting lineup, right? Mm-hmm. And Herb Jones is secure there, and Zion, like, the last image we have of Zion is him being like a world beater, and the last image we have of Brandon Ingram is him getting completely swallowed up by the Thunder defense, and like Lou Dort just putting him in the torture rack for six games. No, four games. And like that being pretty brutal. That is probably not, I agree, that's not like a accurate reflection of all that he is capable of being and doing. And I think, but I, you know, like DeRozan to some degree, what is the value, like finding out what the value is for that player who is clearly good and clearly capable of helping a team, but also like a little bit of a touchy fit in terms of how, what slot in the hierarchy and pecking order that person occupies, and then what role they have to play in that spot in the pecking order, and how comfortable are they doing it? Like, I think all of that, they're interesting and a little bit you have to be creative in terms of how you build around them and getting them to be like, this is where you are in that situation. Also, maybe DeMar DeRozan at, you know, this deep into his career might be a little bit more comfortable saying, I will be that secondary or tertiary player. Ingram in his prime saying like, no, this is where I get my team. I don't know. I think it's fascinating to see where those guys go. There's obviously, we're going to see a ton of player movement. We're going to see a ton of different maneuvers and guys in different situations, guys going back to their settings, you know, new contracts. The entire league is going to go nuts, and we are going to be chronicling it all. Michael Pina, you'll be doing that at The Ringer. Where can people check out more of your work? Anything you want to point people toward? Plug, plug, plug. Here's the opportunity to do it.
TheRinger.com. Go there, read it. I have a 9 biggest questions previewing free agency up on the site right now. I think it just published, so go check that out. And thank you so much, Dan. This was a true blast.
Well, I mean, it's only as good as the co-host. So there we go. That's what I always tell Jake. His hosting job is only ever as good as the co-host. That's all we got for you today. Thank you so much to super producer John Gennaro. The real reason it's good is because of all the things that he does to make the show look and sound great. And then the occasional drop-ins with the tight Dallas Mavericks analysis. What more can you ask for? Subscribe to the Ball Don't Lie podcast on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you are currently listening on. Leave us a 5-star review and tell somebody about it. Helps us with discoverability, helps grow the show. That's all we got. Thank you so much for listening, and we would appreciate it if you'd come back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.